High culture meets high technology at the bleeding edge of the radical right. Majority Rights Radio.
So, do you prefer being called Dr. Nunky or Professor Nunky?
Well, neither really. That term was really given to me by other people on the internet, but I'm self-taught.
Well,
I don't really...
You have a master's degree?
No, just a bachelor's.
Bachelor's?
Yeah. I almost got my master's, but I walked out.
In civil engineering?
Yeah. And then I went back to a master's in public administration, but I walked out during the thesis when I was too busy writing for other journals and stuff. And it always got, my writing in racialist politics always got in the way of my studies. It used to infuriate my wife.
Now, you spent some time in Saudi. Something to do with the oil industry?
Well, as a civil engineer, I went to petrochemicals, consulting. I like to move around a lot.
But you lived in in Saudi?
Yeah, from about 78 to 81. And good experience.
Did you ever see the camel races they have there?
No, not the camel races. Helped a camel into the back of a truck one time.
How was that?
Well, I was glad I was taking the pictures because the other people in our party were getting shit all over.
It was, they say if you're trying to get a camel to the back of the trunk, that, you have to sort
of
get it.
They lower the back of the pickup.
But you sort of have to, get over the hump, as it were. Yeah.
Yeah.
But,
pick the whole
but before that, you were in Wisconsin, right? You graduated from UW-Madison, right?
Yeah.
And before that, you were at Whitewater?
Eau Claire.
Eau Claire. And this was in the 60s?
Yeah, during the riots in Vietnam.
So at that time, were you left-wing or right-wing?
I was neither. And I probably still am... Well, I'm certainly not conservative, and I'm certainly not left-wing. I think if I had to say what I am, I'm a futurist, a dynamist, and no moral, no ethics, just organisms.
What did Raymond Cattell, the psychologist, call his idea for religion? Beyondism, I think it was?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think I agree with that.
But you have all these good stories about Wisconsin in the 60s.
Like which one? At the university?
Oh, just the way people were in the 60s. You remember.
Well, it was very radical. It was interesting watching the left wing and the right wing kind of go at it.
In Madison they were blowing stuff up.
Yeah, I took a lot of photographs and got involved in it in a very peripheral way because of people. I ran around with the left-wing hippie types. Not because of my philosophy, but because they sort of fascinated me and they liked to debate. And that was interesting, But I basically debate with anybody.
Did you have long hair?
Yeah, I had long hair at the time. Their tenaciousness is still to this day one of the puzzles that I go after.
What, you mean like people in SDS and stuff? Weathermen?
Yeah, Weathermen, SDS. What drives them? And I kind of have the feeling that what drives them is the same thing that drives anybody who's ambitious. That if they're not part of the power elite, their mission is to displace the power elite and put themselves in power.
Well, there
and are control.
There are things that one can only accomplish when one is in power. For instance, trying to keep other people from displacing you.
Exactly. But I'm never sure if it's the ideology that they're after or just being able to have the power that goes with it. So that's always been odd to me. Because if I had the power, I would tend not to use the power for my own personal pleasure.
Well, that goes to
if that makes sense.
Asceticism.
Yeah,
austerity.
I don't need much.
Right. And you actually have a theory about austerity and the austere or ascetic personality. I mean, you actually have a theory about, well, for instance, often leaders use their positions for personal aggrandizement, pleasure seeking. And I believe MacDonald, Kevin MacDonald, when he looks at the Middle Ages, he says that a lot of the social structures can be seen as a way to make the whole society cohere better by ensuring that people in the lower classes didn't see people in the upper classes as using their status for their own reproductive success.
Well, I think not in the Middle Ages, but I think, since civilization, there's leaders, religious leaders, kings, pharaohs, politicians, all kinds of leaders that want to make the people believe that they're doing it for them. And I think that's one of the fundamental breakdowns, oddities of anything from dictatorships, totalitarianism, to democracy. They all fall in the same category. The people who are there, even though they have the level of the ruthlessness and paranoia, will dictate how vicious they can be with their own people, like Saddam Hussein, Stalin, Pol Pot. That they're not really any different than the Bush, the Cheneys, the Pearls, and the Wolfowitzes.
Or the they're really not Winston that different. Churchill.
Right. They're really not different. I think I think every once in a while a person will step up who is quite different, that is not interested in that power.
Well, Stalin wasn't, for instance, many of the leaders were sort of ascetic on a personal level. I mean, Stalin, didn't care about his shoes or his where he slept or, he lived pretty much like a peasant.
Yeah, but he was very meticulous about making up lists on the percentage of people that were going to be sent to the gulag.
Well, yeah.
That's power.
Oh, no, absolutely.
It's a little different type.
You know his security chief, Beria?
Yeah.
Do you know how Beria got the job? Beria was Georgian, just like Stalin. And Stalin used to go on vacation in Georgia at a chateau or house somewhere. And Beria was a high-ranking party official. And he was at Stalin's cottage, and there were some bushes growing in the yard that were a little overgrown. And Beria went out and started pulling up the bushes, saying in a loud voice meant to be overheard, "I will uproot anything for Stalin. If he needs anything uprooted, I'll do it."
Yeah.
And that's how he got the job.
Yeah. And he went about that business very well.
Yeah. He didn't outlive Stalin by very much, though.
But that begs the question, then, why is a racialist right any more correct than the left?
We are doing it for the listeners, right? Pure altruism on our part.
Yeah. I think that we have to make sure we stick to that. Not all of us. I mean, I think there are people out there that want to be leaders, want to displace the leaders, want to take over. They don't have the patience. But in the end, I think the one thing we have on our side is empiricism. Different from, I think, the little bit of feeling I get from the European right is they're more literary. But I think in the United States, when it comes to Rushden and MacDonald, Richard Lynn, some of these people, Bouchard, they're leading kind of the revolution in the empiricism that, races are different. And Frank Salter especially, I think.
Where's Michael O'Meara from? Michael O'Meara, where is he from?
He's from Europe, but I can't tell
you. Oh, he is from Europe. Well, I was going to say if he was American, then he was a counterexample because he seems to fall, if you read him, more on the literary side, but he is European.
So. I just ordered his book, so I don't quote me.
Right. Well, if he's European, then it doesn't make the point I was trying to make.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Well, I'll be talking to Sunak next weekend. We're scheduled to...
Yeah, because, strangely, I ordered his book the same time we talked, and there's been a lot of books talking about democracy and its failure. Hoppe and the democracy that failed, but it didn't really satisfy me.
He's at UNLV. Hoppe at UNLV? He's at Las Vegas.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure of the university.
Yeah, I think he's at University of Nevada, Las Vegas.
Yeah, he's one of the few non-libertarian anarcho-capitalists.
I thought he was a libertarian.
He's a libertarian. He's a libertarian who is not open immigration, which to me is a contradiction.
Right.
He's a libertarian that says, yeah, it's not, you know, I don't really appreciate anybody off the street walking into my house.
Right.
With open doors.
Yeah.
And that's how he's different from the established libertarians in the United States who think that open immigration, for some reason, fits in with being a libertarian.
Speaking of libertarians, Atlas Shrugged?
Yeah.
Of course, you don't read fiction, but this was...
I've read her books.
You read her?
Yeah.
Anyway, this will make you very afraid. They're going to make 3 movies out of Atlas Shrugged, a trilogy.
Well, first of all, it doesn't make me afraid.
No, wait. Angelina Jolie as Dagny Taggart. Angelina Jolie as Dagny Taggart. But you remember the cigarettes in Atlas Shrugged? You remember how, like, the good guys were always smoking? Ragnar Danarskjold kept ripping off gold from the UN. He was a pirate. He was a hero. And he had cigarettes that were monogrammed with the dollar sign.
Yeah.
That's really important. All the, like, people who believe in liberty in the book smoke cigarettes. And there's been debate about how they're going to do this in the movie. I mean, cigarettes, like, aren't the done thing on the left, or libertarian. I mean, they don't look good now, but then are you going to have, like, monogrammed gum? Imagine if they had monogrammed gum. That would look stupid.
At that time, they didn't know the consequences of smoking, and I really don't care.
But how are you going to do it in the movie?
You can get around that, you know. They can smoke. I mean, they'll get away with it if they want to.
Yeah, but
if that's content of the movie, it's kind of boring.
Well, but in order to be true to the book, they're not just going to have to smoke. They're going to have to eroticize the act of smoking in some way that's politically meaningful. And I'm saying that's not politically correct. And so Angelina Jolie as Dagny Taggart won't want to be seen.
Well, I'm sure that we have that Ayn Rand's philosophy in a new era can find a way to eroticize
something.
The movement.
Right.
I don't think the people around Ayn Rand formally.
But I just don't see that you can do that with a gun. Right?
There's all kinds of ways to eroticize.
Okay.
And it's constantly changing.
All right. Don't get me started. But we should pause for a word from our sponsor.
America, our strength is our diversity. Diverse people, diverse economy, always growing. Always growing more diverse. We need energy, diverse energy, green energy. As long as America grows, Gig America will grow, because at Gig America, we believe that giga means forever.
Shut the fuck up!
Well, interesting, but frankly, I didn't think much of their business model.
No, it sounds like they're having some problems. Well, we'll have a new sponsor next week, I guess.
I'll try a few.
Oh, yeah, okay. So, Mr. Nucky, so we went through your youth, Saudi Arabia. Did anything interesting happen in the 80s?
I have trouble with this because I'd go home and visit my mother once in a while, and she would mention about you knew this person or that person. And I say, Mother, I've done a lot of shit since I left home. Don't. They come back to me in little episodes. And my wife and I laugh because we've done so much just screwing around. I mean,
You lived in San Francisco.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we just moved around a lot and just did a lot of stuff. So I
stuff that you're proud of in every case.
But interesting things, you know, flying in a small airplane and crashing it, laying it down at a naval base. It's kind of fun for a couple of days, you know, things like that. It's offshore platforms, looking at dolphins every day, going out to ship loading docks, dancing through the night and the weekends, and, you know, just partying.
Right.
You know, just all the kind of stuff that just really, you know.
That doesn't sound completely ascetic.
Well, it's personally enjoyable.
Well,
but
right.
I could put, I mean, you can put that behind you.
Right.
I don't do it, I have never done it in an aggressive, predatory way.
Okay.
I did it with a few friends. We had fun.
Okay, so how about the 90s? The birth of the internet. A new era dawns, and you realize that something is possible that wasn't before.
Yeah, well, I got into eugenics about, I remember, yeah, it was interesting. It was, I was taking class at university in my master's of public administration, and they wanted us to analyze a book. I can't remember what the deal was, but I picked up The Bell Curve. So
that came out in 94.
yeah, fall of 94. And after reading it, I got interested in it again. And I had always been, I always felt that black people needed equality in the sense of meritocracy, that they should float to wherever their talents lie, aside from how I feel about them. And then when affirmative action came in and they got pushy and demanded more of what they deserved, as all the Browns do against the whites, I became radicalized. And the Bell Curve started the process. What's interesting was I got on the internet and could not defend myself very well.
You? That's hard to believe.
Well, I was going up with some very well-trained students.
This wasn't blogs. This wasn't blogs back
then. These were Usenet stuff, you know, where you did debate. And so to counteract that, I just started grabbing books and reading them. And got good at it. If there's an area I didn't know about, couldn't converse with, couldn't win an argument over, I'd get the books and read them and got good at it.
Yeah,
and debates, and then I started the writing. Actually, my website has to do with eugenics, but it has to do a lot of other stuff. I picked one because I'd been interested in that when I was young.
Okay, and that website is.
Even when I was 17 or 18, I knew there were differences between races and people, and they were extreme.
Plug the website. Yes.
Neo-eugenics. Just neo-eugenics. One word.
Neo-eugenics.
.net.
.net.
I'm sorry, .com. I get mixed up. Sorry. I don't go on there very often, so I...
Right. You're doing more at Majority Rights now?
Trying to. I have stuff in family right now that's really digging into my time, but...
How did you get... So the history is this. You were on Usenet. You debated people, and you started reading more and more, and you established a website for your essays, book reviews, stuff like this. The famous neoeugenics.com website. And a couple years ago, you were contacted by guest worker and asked to participate in a new forum called Majority Rights.
Right.
So you were there at the inception.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I don't know how he knew me, but I didn't care. It didn't really matter.
I would assume through neogenics.
Yeah, people. It's people hear of you. They don't. You don't get a lot of email. People don't let you know that they're reading your stuff, and that sort of thing, which is fine. But everyone may come across and go, "Oh yeah, I know you," and. That's nice. You're pulling a few people in. And
I always assumed it was because no one was reading my stuff that I wasn't getting email.
No, I think they tend to read it unless they have something really that they take issue with. Number one, if they really take issue with the site, they just send you a nasty letter or note, and you know that they haven't read it. You know, they just looked at the beginning of it. And you get those once in a while.
But
the people who agree with it and can learn from it, they're not going to write back, and which is good, because you can get in some very tedious and lengthy exchanges with people that take up a lot of time.
But there are limits to the written word. Maybe those limits exist more.
No, you sent me. You told me to read an email or an article today.
Yeah,
it goes beyond the written word, and what it has to do with the fact that the British National Party is positioning itself to be, what, more moderate? Is that the term?
Community
orientated?
No, the British National Party, has always been pretty far right, and in the last few years, they've become controversial on the right because people said they were soft-peddling the JQ, and indeed, they have been doing that publicly. And talking about Islam, not talking about, deporting all newcomers to the British Isles, all that. And this article in The Guardian made it clear why that was. Apparently, at the conference in New Orleans last year, the one David Duke organized, Euro-American Conference.
Mm-hmm.
Nick Griffin actually gave a speech in which he said, look, we're not trying to become a bigger fringe party. We plan to take power, and here's how we're going to do it. We think that if we can be up to, say, 18% of the British electorate, which is no higher than Le Pen has gotten in France, if we can get up to something like 18%, then
you legitimize yourself by having enough numbers of people
right.
who say, yeah, that's what I believe.
Right. But if you can get to like even somewhere under 20%, he believes that there's a crisis coming that deals an economic and ecological crisis. But when this crisis shows itself and people really become upset, in that moment, if he's become moderate enough, the British National Party is seen as acceptable to maybe 18% of the people in Britain, that percentage would be enough to then, expand over 50% very quickly when there was a crisis. So his entire moderation of the party is designed around a belief in a coming catastrophic situation.
Mine also.
In which he would then be positioned to take. He's like, 1 week people don't agree with you, 2 weeks later they do. He says that will happen if we plan it correctly. Now I found that very interesting.
Well, it is because people are easy. Most people have the personality trait of agreeableness, which is sounds like a
if
good
you say
trait,
so.
But
if
not.
You say so,
yeah.
I agree with you.
They agree with the group. Whatever the group believes, they believe. And they stick to it.
Yes. Well, no, I believe that too.
Yeah. But when there's a crisis, they worry. And when there's a crisis, they actually start thinking. And I think that that it will have, we're going to, whether it's overpopulation, I don't like to talk about that because people are predicting it, but at some point, they're going to run out of food in places, there's going to be droughts, whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's when people start to
get involved
in the government, get involved in life, get involved in what it means to live, and what it means to live well and not have it taken away by other people who just want to feed off those who have done well, which is the West.
How soon
We've
is now?
We've invented everything.
How soon is now?
You can't predict that. I don't think, if you could predict it, we'd all be incredibly wealthy. And people say that you can predict the housing market or anything else, it's always after the fact.
Yeah.
There may be a few geniuses that can see it coming, but not many.
Not many.
It's already too late.
Well, it's getting late, I think. And that's...
But the difference between you and I is you see it as a bad thing and I see it as a good thing.
I don't see it as a bad thing.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
Not at all.
I just thought you did, like peak oil, and I think that humans have lived on a lot less. We have an
A lot fewer humans have lived on the Wild West.
Yes. And we'll get through it again. And I think our people are the most important thing, that we come through it.
I'm not saying that I buy Richard Duncan's old device stuff, like, completely, or J. Hansen's dieoff.org. But those things are worth reading and worth being familiar with. In fact, I'd like to interview Duncan if I could get him.
Yeah. Because I'm interested in the bottleneck effect, again.
Which?
The bottleneck effect. Going through a bottleneck effect of humans, and I won't say numbers if it's a billion or 100 million, that when they come out the other side, they have the intellect to actually be rational.
Right.
Which humans are not now. Humans go along, they get along, they agree with the politics.
Oh, you're right.
It's interesting that, you know, genetics has so much to do with your personality traits. But just like religion, you're born into a Democratic or Republican family. And you stick to it, for the most part. It doesn't seem to have much to do with genes. It has to do with indoctrination.
That's funny.
And mindless indoctrination. How about you be more mindless than being born into a religious family and believing that is the only religion that has value, purpose, or meaning?
Did I ever tell you about...
I mean, it's ridiculous at face value.
Well, I hate to say it, but I can actually confirm what you said about family of origin. I never told you about my family of origin. But would it surprise you to learn that my parents were heavily into the... They weren't hippies. They were heavily into the counterculture. But they read Paul Ehrlich and Limits to Growth and, you know, Organic Gardening Will Save Us and Catastrophe is Coming. And that doesn't surprise you?
No, not at all.
Really?
Yeah, because number one, they were intellects.
Right.
And intellects have to do something with the brain.
Right.
And I think intellects also probably tend not to be your business people.
Well, usually reason employs itself in making the owner unhappy.
You mean being rational?
Well,
or
usually, I think, or very often, we use our minds to worry, right? I mean, when I was 10, my grandparents had this Labrador Retriever named... you ever seen these Labrador Retrievers with their fairly short legs? Looks like a sausage?
Yeah.
I think they've bred that out of them now. Maybe they got rid of some of the stupidity, too. Anyway, there was this stupid Labrador my grandparents had called Frobisher. Martinique Frobisher. After, of course, Martin Frobisher, who discovered Labrador in Canada. Mm-hmm. So anyway, Frobisher got hit by a car, was injured, recovered, took her to the vet, you know, but she's, you know, like, injured her hindquarters, she can't walk, she's moaning in pain. And some grown-up explained to me that it's not as bad for dogs as it is for people to be in pain.
And because they deal with it.
Because they don't fear. They have no anxiety about the future.
If their side is ripped open because another dog bit them, they don't have fear that they're going to bleed to death.
They don't think, how am I going to recover?
No.
Am I going to have to be in a cast? Is the nurse going to see my underwear? They don't fear.
Yeah, they don't. Exactly. But what's interesting with humans is, being human, we're very aware of what we need to be precautious about. And that's very deeply ingrained in human behavior. That is, when you dream, I'm not sure what I know what dreams are all about, I don't think anybody does. But yes, we have to constantly think about what is dangerous.
Right.
I mean, a savvy person realizes that probably isn't smart walking with headphones and loud music
where people
through downtown Chicago, crossing streets at oddball, you know, angles, is probably not a smart thing to do, because I seem to almost hit somebody every day.
Yeah, I remember in Pittsburgh.
It's very dangerous. Yeah,
15 years ago,
and I'm aware of that. But there,
I remember in one of the parks, Shenley Park in Pittsburgh, 15 years ago, I was riding my mountain bike on.
And I just don't want to be sued. Understand? That's the only thing.
On a wide gravel path, and there was a young woman walking, listening to headphones. And I rode my mountain bike past her, and she startled. I mean, she visibly startled, like I had, like, really scared her. And I thought, you know, why are you wearing headphones then? If you want to be able to hear people riding up behind you.
Exactly. But humans are, humans do practice a lot of precaution. They have a total inability to understand the probabilities. I mean, we still moan over 3,000 people that died in the World Trade Center.
I thought it was that Iraq?
Thousands of Americans dying from car accidents, from cancer, from all kinds of things.
Wait, wasn't
and
that
nobody seems to care?
Cancer wasn't. Didn't that take Americans last year?
I'm not sure. I don't keep count, but really,
it seems like a nice figure, though.
Yeah. And it's so irrelevant. And the nice thing is, there are no injuries. They were dead, or all right, for the most part. Except for the lung disease.
Oh, yeah. You're talking about the trade towers again.
Yeah.
Yeah, it turned out to be a bad thing. I guess people just, like, blew off the respirators. I mean, they had masks, but most of them didn't wear
them. Well, that was an environmental disaster. But even now, I mean, at work and stuff like that, I don't know of anybody who's afraid of terrorism. They talk about it, like, this is crap. I'm tired of using my ID to get into the building.
Yeah.
But I don't know of anybody who's afraid of terrorism or cares.
Yeah, why is everybody so worried about ID? I mean, shouldn't we worry about EGO?
EGO.
EGO, ID, id, ego.
Yeah.
Okay. I can cut that out.
It puzzled me. I find it all very annoying. I'm willing to live, I'm going to die.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to die. I don't want to die in a perfectly safe world. It's too boring. And I don't want to live in a reckless world where I'm getting pissed at somebody that's running off the road either.
Now, isn't there some quote by somebody famous about those who want to live, let them fight? Those who do not want to fight in this world of eternal struggle do not deserve to live. Who was that?
I don't know. Oh, Hitler?
Really? Oh, I'm shocked. I thought it was from one of our great quotable leaders like George W. Bush.
The more I read about Adolf, the more, it's a fascinating... It's so different from what history tells us.
Yeah,
Number one, it wasn't totalitarian. It was a chaotic bunch of bureaus within the Nazi Party fighting amongst themselves for power.
Yeah, have you read Irving's book? Have you read Irving's books?
Yeah.
I've never read them. Are they good?
Yeah. Yeah, he's superb.
Yeah.
But this came out, I just read Becoming Eichmann, and they pointed out how it was just a society that was trying to get through the Depression, trying to get their lives put back together. Hitler, on the other hand, didn't want to go to war. I mean, the guy, he liked it. He liked it.
War?
Yeah, because of the First World War, because of the Versailles.
He loved that. Apparently he loved living in the trenches. And
yeah.
He wasn't.
Yeah.
But you know who else was like
Stalin
that?
Was gated up in Moscow doing, like a chicken shit.
You know who else?
Sending out the rest of the people to go die.
You know who had the same personality? Tim McVeigh. Apparently Tim McVeigh was a very good soldier in the First World War. Someone who served under the First Gulf War.
Gulf War.
I think the man he served under said, if I had a unit full of McVeighs, that would be ideal. He was like the ideal soldier. Didn't care about drinking, didn't care about women, cared about... And
like to kill.
I don't know about that, but he wanted to be in the Special Forces, and he... He didn't have enough time to exercise and prepare after he got back from the Gulf, and they gave him the task and he flunked and he left the service, and that's when he became embittered or whatever you call it.
Yeah.
I'm not defending the man. But I just thought it was interesting.
But he acted out his dream.
Yeah. Painful to live in fear, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well,
you can fight it, I think. I mean, it's I'm not so sure what I'm fearful sometimes. It's fearful of, but not that much.
Yeah. You know, we definitely have more to talk about, and we should definitely do this again soon.
Yeah, there is so much. I mean, every time I read a book, I get slices of humans' inability to understand themselves. They really don't have much of a handle on who they are, or why they are, or why they care. But I think a lot of the fear thing, I mean, genetically humans have been programmed, like every organism, to hang on to life to its bitter end, no matter what.
But I thought all that biologically based stuff had been repealed by the 20th century in humanism.
They're trying.
You know, I mean, sure, a billion years of evolution was all based on struggle, chaos, murder, and hostility. But, and sure, the things we think of as good, you know, love, family, altruism, evolved in a creature that lived in small groups,
mm-hmm.
and was nice inside that group, and was, so, amity within, enmity without, enmity without.
Absolutely, destroy the enemy.
Right.
Protect
but the point is, even though, as Heraclitus said, war is the universal parent, war is the father of all things,
mm-hmm.
even though that's always been true, I thought that I heard that it had been repealed sometime in the 20th century, and that now things were different.
Well, media would certainly like you to believe that.
Hmm. I should check into that.
Because I'm reading the books I read, the battle that goes on in academia between those who want to just dismiss humans as having any genetic base whatsoever. You know, it's all so political. It's all preordained.
Do you know any academics, like, you know, semi-Marxist political science types, people like in...
Oh, I met them in school. I mean...
So you don't know any now?
No, I don't really talk to them that much.
They're interesting to talk to because they have to deny so much now that is... Well, just in IQ, for instance, you're aware that, you know, there is no serious academic debate about the existence of an IQ gap between races.
There's a serious debate. There just is no empirical evidence for the left.
Well, there isn't. Nobody's actually seriously... Well, where it comes from, that's still being debated in genetics, environment. Nobody disputes the fact that there's a gap. They've just stopped talking about it. But the thing is, there are many issues like this, but that mostly deal with the emerging science of humans that... that they can't look at or talk about or suffer to be talked about directly, but also around that area. So if a conversation gets anywhere near that area, distortions appear in the conversation to keep you from getting there. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's our advantage, that we don't have to distort in order to keep them from making us talk about something that we're vulnerable on. Because they won't come to us and talk about things we're vulnerable on.
They primarily, at this point, right now in the nature-nurture debate, their primary technique is repetition. Repetition of flawed statements, distorted statements, and getting it into the media via the... I mean, the social sciences put out so many reports and so many
The point is that on some level they've already lost, and they know they've lost.
They seem to be very fearful.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, they are.
And they're angry.
Yeah.
They're very angry. And I think, I'm going to retract that. They're not angry. They're afraid.
They're both.
Yeah.
Both.
They're
both.
Very afraid. These people, you can set them off, and they just go ballistic.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, if you win an argument against me, I go, hey, you got me. I'll go do some research. But these people get... I mean, they'll call you names. Something I'd never do to somebody. You know, I have no reason to call someone I know who's intelligent a moron.
No.
They're not a moron.
Oh, no, I've...
They have behavioral differences from me.
Right. Anyway, I hope that we can get some of these people on the show. I hope we can get someone from the... someone very intelligent from the left.
Yeah, that would be very interesting. I'd be fascinated to hear why they do it.
Well,
I mean, take a look at the environment. I live in a pristine environment compared to 100 years ago. Pristine.
Yeah, well, this is nice, yeah.
I drive a car, you know, there's, you know, you go to the doctor, you know, they knock you out before they do anything to you. They don't just yank a tooth by, you know, giving you a swig of whiskey. I mean,
just look at this wallpaper. You know what the last words Oscar Wilde said were? He died in a shabby hotel room after having been, you know, as the poet and all this. And his last words were, either this wallpaper goes or I do.
Yeah.
Your wallpaper made me think of that.
Oh, either it goes or here you go?
No, it's not bad. It's, what's a little repetitious, though?
It's easy to take care of.
Yeah.
And if you want, you know, what the thing is with wallpaper, when you've got a lot of paintings and stuff, which we don't have up here yet, because we just opened up, you know, just put it together.
It's so gaudy. It
breaks it up.
It could be wrapping paper. It's so gaudy.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
My wife picked it out. She likes it.
Yeah, okay. Any last words for the viewers? Viewers. Why did I say viewers? Because, we should be expanding into video soon.
Yeah, that could be interesting. I'd like to see that.
If you want to reach the kids, Matt.
My feeling is that there's a market for video and audio on the internet. So when I turn on TV, there are no debates. There's nothing.
Look, you know, the hope doesn't rest with your generation or my generation.
No.
Matt, it rests with the kids, gosh darn it. The kids of America and of Europe, you know? I mean, gosh, if the kids could just, like, see how much the thinkers of, say, the European New Right, you know, have to offer the youth of today. Don't you think?
Do you know what I think? So there's a little bit of battle between my wife and I.
Well, we can't talk about this on the internet.
No, it's just not that type of battle.
Oh,
it's
okay.
What do you do with your money when you die? Because we don't have children, all right? I would like to take all my money and have surrogate children. You buy the egg, the sperm, frozen.
You
put them together, and you find a surrogate mother and go, here's some money.
Yeah?
Have a kid.
What does your wife think of this?
Oh, I don't talk to her about that.
I thought you said you were having a battle with her.
No, internal. Not verbal.
Oh,
not in the open.
Oh. So you think that our listeners
find it appropriate that you're telling them about some spiritual battle about fertility? No. It's just a thought that goes through my head. You know, I'm thinking, you know, my wife, we should get a will. We should, you know, decide where money is going to go. Her attitude is to spend it all before she dies. My attitude is...
She's pretty good at that, right?
Yeah, she's very good at that. And my attitude is, if I have anything left, you know, and it gets close to the end, I'd like to give it to, like, the Pioneer Fund or something, but sponsor this program where maybe we could have, I think I wrote about this, identical sperm and ovum from two different individuals with extremely high IQ that would be carried by 10 different women, so they're all identical twins in 10 different environments.
Right.
It's a perfect Bouchard Jensen experiment.
Yeah.
Inheritability.
Right. Fascinating.
And I wouldn't be careful about the environment, as long as they're normal.
You know, we've run over time again, so until next week, this is Soren Renner and
Matt Nunke
saying, this is propaganda.